Paranormal Perception is brought to you by Sabrina Marie's book, Two Realm Paranormal, Torn Between Realms. It's available now on barnesandnoble.com or on the paranormalperception.show homepage.
Paranormal Perception is a full-bodied apparition summoned by 22 Creations Multimedia LLC.
You've found it. Your guide through the unknown. This is your guide through the new normal for the new decade. Paranormal Perception. Parapsychology.
Restless souls.
Cryptozoology. Disclosure. Ghosts. Artificial intelligence. Unheard whispers. Close your eyes. Open your ears and your mind. It is called the unknown for a reason.
By the end of this episode, you'll have a new perception on the paranormal.
A Paranormal Perception
with Henry San Miguel.
You will have a new perception on the paranormal. This week especially, like I teased last week, it's all of you that love true crime, that listen to true crime podcasts, you're going to love the topic today. We'll get to that in just a second. Before that, though, first, a thank you. I already got, I think it was two, maybe three. I think I saw a third one this morning. But you've already sent in some Christmas ghost stories, so thank you for that. Those of you that haven't and you're wondering, wait, what? Christmas stories? Yeah, we're going to do the same thing. I mentioned it last week. If you missed it, see, that's why you should listen to every week-ish, why you should listen to new episodes. But I mentioned that for this year's Christmas Eve episode, we're going to do the same thing we did for the Halloween episode, which is tell your ghost stories. Because it's a long, long tradition. It's long forgotten by now. But it used to be a tradition in Victorian times that instead of opening up presents, and that was there, but instead of just opening presents on Christmas, you also gathered the family around the fire, because it's usually cold in December, a lot colder than it is in October, and you start telling ghost stories. Out of that, like I mentioned last week also, came arguably the most well-known, the most famous of Christmas ghost stories, Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. There's been a million adaptations, film, radio shows, book, obviously, all kinds of things. But it's arguably the most known. But that's not the only one. There have been other Christmas stories through time, and people just made them up. So I figured, you know, this Paranormal Perception, you guys did great sending in stories for the Halloween episodes. Why not do it for Christmas Eve? And yeah, we'll be with our families. We'll celebrate. But it's Paranormal Perception. We all like the spooky no matter what. So let's share the stories. Again, just go to the website. If you're not there already, there's an orange button that says start recording. You click it and you start recording. You start recording your story. And it can be something that you've experienced, a real life paranormal experience. Your brush with the other side. It could be a song, a spooky song that you wrote. And I got to say, it doesn't have to be something that happened to you around Christmas time. It can be any time. We just happen to be sharing them on Christmas Eve. But if it did happen on Christmas, well, even better. Fits the mood. So you can, like I said, it could be a story, it could be a song, it could be a poem, anything to scare us. And we'll do that on Christmas Eve. That's how we'll celebrate it here on Paranormal Perception. So I teased you what the topic, what the guest is going to be about. So in a moment, we'll get into some true crime right after you hear all about the sponsor.
With 30 years of paranormal investigations and research under their belts, a lifetime of experiences and the gifts that make it all worth it, Two Realm Paranormal truly live the paranormal. This mother-daughter investigative team has experienced it all, and they go anywhere needed in search of answers with a single goal in mind, helping both the living and the dead. Their new book was written for those who feel like they're going crazy in a paranormal nightmare, so they know they are not alone. Filled with their experiences, theories, and even a little fun, it's definitely a book every paranormal enthusiast needs in their collection. Two Realm Paranormal, Torn Between Realms is written by Sabrina Marie and is available for shipping now at barnesandnoble.com. Just search the number 2, Realm Paranormal. We now return you to your unscheduled awakening. This is Paranormal Perception.
And we're back on Paranormal Perception. Now, let you know how you can get your ghost stories in for the Christmas Eve episode later on. But now, like I said, I've been teasing you since last week. Those of you that love listening to true crime podcasts and reading true crime stories, you're going to love today's guest. Today's guest is Jesse P. Pollock. He's a contributing writer for Weird NJ magazine. He's has been since 2001. His first book, Death on the Devil's Teeth, co-authored with Mark Morin, was published in 2015. His latest book, The Acid King, is available now in bookstores and online, and of course that means including Amazon. And it's been adapted into a feature film that was co-directed with Dan Jones. And it was released earlier this week. It's available now on demand. And I have a link on the show description for all of you to go and watch it. And watch it, you will want to. Jesse, welcome to the show. How you doing?
I'm doing well, Henry. But I need more cowbell. Sorry, I can't hear Don't Fear the Reaper without thinking of that now. It's funny how one goofy little Saturday Night Live kind of changed the whole perception of a song that had already been in rotation for, I guess, 30 years as a classic by that point. So I wonder how Blue Oyster Cult feels about that.
I think they're okay with it. And I love the fact that you, out of all the guests that I've had, maybe because you skew on the younger side, nobody's ever brought up that reference, and nobody even knows what I've said it. And it's like crickets.
Oh, that's terrible. Well, we should mess with them all, and I can just do the rest of the interview as walking, really annoy everyone. So I wrote this Satanic Panic book, and it's now a movie, and it's very, very spooky. You know, Frankenstein never scared me. No, I won't do it the whole show.
Well, I was kind of hoping you would actually.
If I find a natural segue to bring it back again, I'll take advantage of it.
Okay, looking forward to that. Maybe I might steer it that way. Yeah. And by the way, that wasn't walking. Somebody walking in. If you're listening to the podcast, like, wait, how did Christopher Walken get on this podcast? That wasn't him.
I can go anywhere. I have many powers. I'm a witcher. Yeah.
I'm glad I'm recording this. So let me before we get into the actual documentary, let me start with how you Jesse, how'd you find out about Ricky Castle's story, and what made you want to tell his story?
Well, when I was working on the first book, Death on the Devil's Teeth, I quickly realized that story, which was similar to the Castle case, it involved a teenager being found dead in the woods. And a public outcry that led to newspapers trying to blame the poor girl's death on anything from a witch's cult to, Satanists, any sort of Halloween spookiness that you can think of. And I quickly realized that, you know, this is one of the prototypical Satanic Panic cases. Now, I was born in 1988. So growing up in the early 90s, I was tangentially aware of the Satanic Panic. Like, I would see things on the news. Like, I remember they at one point tried to make Goosebumps books out to be some sort of a Satanist plot.
Yeah.
But, you know, looking at this first case in Devil's Teeth, which happened all the way back in 1972, it became really clear again that, okay, well, this was part of the genesis of what later exploded in the 80s and 90s. So I brushed up on the other big Satanic Panic cases that a lot of people, you know, they're basically household names now, if you're familiar with all of that, you know, Sean Sellers and Mike Warnke and the Judas Priest suicides and the whole Ozzy Osbourne suicide solution thing. But the one story that I kept seeing referenced in the Satanic Panic lore that I was researching at the time was one that somehow I didn't really hear about growing up. And I did not grow up too far away from where this happened. I grew up in suburban New Jersey, about a half hour outside of Manhattan. So Northport, Long Island, where the Ricky Castle story happened, was only about a 2-hour drive away from me. But somehow by the mid 90s, when I became, you know, aware of this whole social thing going on, Castle wasn't talked about anymore. It was, you know, it was Judas Priest and Suicide Solution, like I said, with Ozzy. And the McMartin preschool trial was another one. So every time I would see this, go, Ricky Casso, why does that not like ring a bell at all? And I found that the only book that had been written about it was this book called Say You Love Satan by David St. Clair that came out in 1987. And I saw it was no longer in print. And I ordered an old used copy of it off of eBay for like $4. And I just kind of flipped through it and got a feel for the general idea of the story and was like, wow, you know, this whole thing, you know, a teenage devil worshiper that, you know, dug up bones in graveyards and supposedly had a connection to a satanic cult, if not, you know, the full blown leader of one, and eventually, you know, stabbed his friend in the woods over 36 times and was leading tours to the body for weeks and supposedly was doing rituals at the Amityville Horror House. It was like, Jesus, what a story. You know, I realized there was already a book about it, but I always thought like this would be a very interesting story to come back to if the opportunity ever arose. And the way that fate would have it, the opportunity arose very quickly after the release of Death on the Devil's Teeth. It became a local bestseller in New Jersey, obviously, you know, due to it being where the case happened. But it was released right at the right time as true crime culture was, you know, given sort of a resurgence through podcasts like Serial. Mm-hmm. And I think Making a Murderer was around at that point. So it got a decent amount of attention for this little book about a case that was not known on a national level and was released by a modest publisher. Like, and I'm not knocking them in any way at all because History Press and Arcadia Publishing have been great to us. But they were a publisher that mostly dealt with history books that you would see in the gift shop of a museum or maybe at a travel stop on your way across country. But, you know, this little book took on a life of its own. And so someone at Simon & Schuster noticed, and when they were having lunch with my literary agent, Eric Myers, someone asked him like, hey, would Jesse be interested in doing a true crime book for this new true crime line that we're working on called Simon True? And Eric said, I'll run it by him. Is there any other information he needs to know before he makes a decision or an offer? And they said, we want it to be teen centric. So if he could pick a case that, you know, the culprit and the victim are both teenagers, that would fit in better with the line. And when he ran that by me, I immediately thought the Ricky Casso and Gary Lowers case. So I quickly typed up a proposal and a couple sample chapters and sent it over. And they said, yep, we love it. Get started. Here's your due date and we'll talk to you then. And I immediately got to work doing what I did with my first book. And that was, okay, I'm going to get as much of the original newspaper coverage as I can find. I'm going to make a list of names and I'm going to try and find these people and just start talking to them, build up like my own sort of case file of interviews. And as I spoke to more and more people from Northport who knew Ricky Casso and Gary Lowers in life, it became very apparent that the case was completely misrepresented in the media. It was grossly misrepresented in the Say You Love Satan book. And the couple television documentaries and TV specials that came in the wake of all of that weren't much better. Like there was a piece that was done on 2020 about the case. There was a Discovery Channel special in the very early 2000s. Geraldo even threw his hat in the Ricky Casso ring at one point. There's a hysterical clip in this whole episode he devoted to, you know, teenage devil worship, where he has Ozzy Osbourne dialing in via satellite, and he's trying to get Ozzy to apologize for his lyrics. And, you know, Ozzy's just like, yeah, you're so wrong. You're judging a book by its cover, man. And it's hysterical just how crazy it all went. And that's when I realized, okay, here is a real opportunity here to not just do a generic retread of Say You Love Satan. You know, the story here is now going to be the story of finding the true story that had been buried by the media myth. And that set me off on a quest that lasted over 3 years of basically tracking down and gaining the trust of anyone I could find who had known Ricky Castle and Gary Lowers, and getting the true story of this horrific crime and giving back the story to the people who lived it and had their lives completely uprooted by it.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about it when I went, because I've seen the documentary a couple of times now. You did a great job on it, both of you guys.
Thank you.
But I don't remember. Because I'm a little bit older now. Hearing you kind of date yourself, I'm a little bit older than you. Because I was a teenager around the time when Ricky was. So
okay.
I lived through that satanic panic. But I don't remember hearing Ricky's story. I remember hearing. Mainly because I was part of it. I was playing it. I remember all the stuff about D&D and you know, the heart and the metal music and all of that, which to me, I mean, as a kid, it was like, yeah, whatever. But Ricky's story, I never really heard until it was, I think a few years ago. I forget how. And then obviously when I got the press release for your story. But it's a story that now that I've seen the movie and I went back, like most people do when you listen to true crime, it acts as a gateway. They just start doing their own research, looking up like, hey, is this true? All that. And I a lot of the things were typical, I will say. Yeah, all the stuff.
It's this weird kind of thing with that.
Yeah.
That goes back to, like I was saying, like he wasn't a household name, but when it happened, it set off an immediate shockwave, and it was an international story. As we talk about in the book, in the film, there were reporters from England and Japan there. But I think because of a bunch of different circumstances that happened almost in the immediate wake of it, the press quickly moved on, and I don't want to say they had bigger fish to fry, but other more sensational stories started coming out at the same time. I believe it was only 18 months later, you had Richard Ramirez, and that was another satanic panic thing that they coincidentally, or maybe not coincidentally, we'll never know, but they tied into the whole AC/DC panic and all of that. Like Ricky Castle was arrested wearing an AC/DC shirt, and of course the press went wild with the booking photo, and Richard Ramirez left an AC/DC hat behind at a crime scene, and you know, there was all that. And then I think less than 2 years later was also the Judas Priest suicides. So it was, even in a day and age before the 24-hour news cycle, I think there were so many opportunities for the press to keep throwing these, you know, sensational spins like, oh, hey, we got another kid that blew his head off listening to heavy metal, or, you know, hey, we've got another pastor here from a megachurch that wants to talk about how Rainbow Bright is going to turn your kids into a murderer or something. I think the Castle case kind of got lost in the shuffle there.
Yeah, I want to say there's a lot of localism, too, because you mentioned Richard Ramirez. Him, I knew about because I grew up in San Francisco, and I'm in the LA area now. So being there, I mean, that was literally ground zero. So every night, every hour, I heard Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker. But Ricky's story, like I said, I don't remember his story, which I should have, because he was my age around that time, and it is quite the story, as you guys will see as you watch the film. If you aren't already familiar with his story, now for you, Jesse, for doing the research, especially talking to people that actually lived through that time, through the story, and knew Ricky and all his friends, what did you learn new by talking to them?
Well, the way that the story was initially presented in the media was that Ricky was your all-American kid who at some point in junior high smoked a joint, and it set him off on this wild path of destruction where he, you know, became a Satanist and was the leader of a satanic cult, and his parents had desperately tried to help him, and he rejected everything, and nothing could be done for him. You know, they really made him out to be this feral, you know, monster that came out of nowhere. Or, you know, if they did try to put some sort of an underline on it, it was, oh, it's because he started smoking pot in middle school and discovered Ozzy Osbourne around the same time. And the biggest revelation to me was how much that wasn't the case. It was, you know, he was the all-American kid and you know, your average suburbanite middle schooler when things started to go wrong, but it wasn't because he started smoking pot or, you know, listening to Ozzy Osbourne or anything like that. It was because he was rebelling against his father. His father, Dick Casso, was a well-known and well-liked athlete in the Northport area. His own father, Alfred Casso, was a minor league baseball player before him. So there was this trend in the family of, you know, we expect athletic excellence out of you. By the time Ricky was in middle school, his father was a wrestling coach. He was a football coach. He was a teacher at Cold Spring Harbor High School. So there was this expectation of him of you're going to do well in school and you're going to be a football star. And the second this kid hit puberty and decided he didn't care about football anymore, his father pretty much took the attitude of, I don't have any use for you anymore. And there was constant clashing in the house. The father would look for any reason to start a conflict with Ricky. I interviewed several people who witnessed an incident where Ricky didn't want to get a haircut. And so his father chased him down the block with a pair of scissors. And when Ricky outran him, his father went in the house and took his scissors and chopped up all of his clothes and threw them on the front lawn, things like that. And then eventually, yeah, the pot use started, much like, you know, most kids in that era. I mean, I can't speak for the 80s personally because I was born in 88, like I mentioned earlier, but I started smoking pot around the same time. You know, I was in probably my freshman year of high school. I was in a band and, you know, pot was around. And I imagine it wasn't that different for him at 13, 14 years old in suburban Long Island. And it got to the point where he was experiencing regular beatings from his father. We interview one friend of Ricky's in the film who told us this terrible story of, oh yeah, Ricky came to school with bruises all over his chest one day, and we asked what happened, and he, you know, told us about how his father had beaten him with a broomstick because he missed football practice the night before. Yeah. So it became what started out as the story of, oh my God, the good kid gone wrong because of drugs and rock and roll, which I didn't believe so much anyway. I figured that was some sort of an exaggeration there, but it instead turned into this portrait of child abuse and a toxic home environment that culminated in Ricky being thrown out to live in the streets at either 13 or 14 years old. Accounts differ on which one, but by the time high school started for him, he was living in the woods. And if it was too cold to sleep in the woods, he was breaking into, you know, parked cars that were left on Main Street in Northport. There's another really sad story that's in the book in the movie about how he had to take refuge in a public bathroom next to a sewage treatment plant. So, you know, this is someone who's 13 or 14 years old sleeping on, you know, a urine soaked floor, you know, in a public bathroom that already reeks from being next to a sewage treatment plant. And, you know, when you have to fend for yourself like that at such an early age, he was definitely self-medicating with pot. I'm sure he didn't feel great about himself or his life, you know, sleeping in the woods or in a bathroom. And that led to him experimenting with LSD, and he eventually became the chief supplier of it in Northport, hence the Acid King nickname. And it became his only real way of supporting himself, drug dealing. And it got to the point where he was taking some major risks in engaging in that kind of profession, you know. Trying to explain it to, and you'll remember this because you were around the same age as him. It's hard explaining this to a younger audience, but the Bronx back in the early to mid 80s was not the Bronx that it is now. I mean, Ronald Reagan visited the Bronx as president and compared it to Warsaw during World War II, just this bombed out, desolate war zone. There was extreme poverty, extreme desperation in that area, and it was very dangerous. And for Ricky, who was, you know, by this point probably 15 years old, to be venturing into the South Bronx alone by taking a train to pick up large quantities of drugs so that he would have some sort of income so he could buy cheap bologna and some white bread, it is really telling. And anytime he would try to go straight and repair his relationship with his family, it would just always go south for the dumbest reasons. He went back to his home. He got himself into therapy on his own. There was a therapy center on Main Street in Northport where anyone could just drop in. It was geared towards teenagers. It was called The Place. And he was regularly attending counseling sessions there. He had gotten himself back into school. And one day he left school a few minutes early with some friends to go hang out. And word got back to his father. And his father kicked him back out on the street again.
Yeah.
You know, for something that simple. So it just became this snowball effect of his situation. No matter how hard he tried, just kept getting worse and worse and worse. And, you know, again, when all your life is sleeping on the cold dirt or sleeping in a wet bathroom, and you have to go through all this terrible crap, you know, drug dealing to make money, it really does something to your psyche. And this is a kid that was already experiencing problems at home that led to this. He was diagnosed with manic depression around this time, which we now know as bipolar disorder. And all of this culminated into the single event that really kicked this crime off, which was Ricky's friend Gary Lowers stealing a bag of PCP out of Ricky's pocket while he was passed out at a party. And I mean, as we go into in the book and of course the film, it just led to this real roller coaster of a series of beatings that Ricky inflicted on Gary. Because it wasn't just, you know, oh, well, he stole from me. That's humiliating. It was also, well, he stole my supply from me that I use to sell and buy food because I don't have anywhere to live. Yeah. So
it's his livelihood, basically.
And his livelihood. And I'm not excusing what Ricky Casso did at all, but it's an effort to understand it. It went beyond much more than a matter of childish pride. It was, you know, well, here was someone that he had known almost his entire life. You know, these guys had gone back to grade school. I have a photo of them in second grade together. And it's, you know, Ricky Casso had fallen on such hard times for the past 4 years by this point that for someone that he thought was his friend to steal his only means of getting any income to take care of himself, it just set him off. And that combined with a series of other unfortunate events in Ricky's life at the time, I think really became the catalyst of him just not caring anymore. And he eventually confronted Gary about this in the presence of two other friends, Jimmy Troiano and Albert Quinones. And it led to Gary's murder and the series of incredibly dramatic and terrifying events that are documented in the book and the film.
Yeah, Jesse, have you done interviews for this on another paranormal type shows, or is this the first one you do?
Probably. I've been promoting the book for about 3 years now, so I'm sure there's. I did David Schrader's show one time. I guess you could clarify that as paranormal.
Yeah, definitely. The his dark radio. Yeah,
Darkness Radio. That's the one.
Uh huh. Yeah. Well, the reason why I'm asking that is because, again, this is Paranormal Perception. So this is where I bring in the paranormal side, the occult. It's actually part of that. But from from everything you research and now knowing his story a lot more, especially from the actual witnesses who knew him and who know more, are you convinced that while not satanic, maybe something demonic? Because as I talk about on the show, there is a difference between the two. Maybe not satanic, because that is more man-made. Demonic, you just have no control over it. I mean, do you think a lot of it could have been demonic, a demonic thing leading Ricky to do what he ultimately did?
Well, I certainly can't speak for that, but I definitely know that he himself was under the perception that there was something at play there. Now, while Ricky Casso was not the leader of the teenage satanic cult as the press tried making him out to be, he did have an interest in the occult and Satanism. He read the Satanic Bible. He, you know, like a lot of other kids at the time, would play Ozzy Osbourne records backwards, looking for secret messages, etc. And he sought out occult books at the Northport Public Library. But, you know, to a lot of other people around him at the time, it just seemed to be, you know, normal teenage stuff. But as you got closer to the murder and the days after, he was telling people closest to him that he thought that he was communicating directly with the devil. He told a few friends that Satan had come to him in the form of a glowing tree that had sprouted out of the ground in Estakia Woods, where he killed Gary. Now, of course, you have to take that with a quarry of salt, because this is also a kid that had been eating LSD and PCP for breakfast for, you know, about 2 years at this point. But he definitely seemed to believe it himself. And even during the murder, he was commanding Gary to say he loved Satan, which is where you get that phrase that's become sort of a pop culture thing now. Say You Love Satan was used, I believe it was a song of Rob Zombie's. I know he named one of his tours after it. And then, of course, there's the Say You Love Satan podcast that's out there right now. And even Richard Ramirez instructed one of his early victims to say they loved Satan, which made me kind of wonder during the research of my book if there had been some sort of, I don't want to say he was a Ricky Casso copycat, but there did seem to be some sort of influence there. If not, it was an incredible coincidence. I mean, you would have two young killers, both named Richard, both telling a victim to say they love Satan and both wearing AC/DC apparel. So,
yeah, you know, you're right. Actually, I didn't even think of that until you're saying it right now. I mean, and I was actually about to ask you, because I don't know. Do you know, were there any copycats shortly after? Not Richard Ramirez, but just any other copycats?
There were a series of incidents in Northport that, while they were not copycat killings, there were strange things like there was a couple of teenagers who had spray painted Satan on some cars and some buildings and lit them on fire and tried making it seem like a satanic cult was responsible for it. But the police quickly caught on that, you know, that these are dumb kids that read about what was going on in the newspapers and decided to use it as an excuse to act out. But luckily, as far as copycat murders, none happened in Northport.
See, if they wrote Satan instead of Satan, maybe they'd be copycat.
Exactly. And that was the big irony in this case, too, when you looked at the media coverage of it, because they definitely, you know, had people, you know, one of the news reports, you see it in the trailer and in the film, you know, you have newscasters on, you know, one of the three major networks saying, you know, people are worried that these, you know, Satan worshipers are going to take their teens next. And it's like, they couldn't even spell Satan right, Ricky and his friends. If you look at the photos, and we show them in the film of the park downtown where they all hung out at the time, it's satin.
Yeah,
it's hysterical. This would honestly, if there wasn't the tragedy of another young man being murdered,
it would almost be funny.
It would be like a great Coen Brothers movie. Yeah. But it's the horrific things that happened that night in the woods, and the terrible things that happened in the wake of it in that town, kind of prevent it from that. But it is almost a surreal kind of River's Edge scenario.
But you not just that, but you know what also told me, and this is because I've been in on the radio side of things. I've been around radio since I was 10 years old. So it was already around me at the time. I didn't hear that. You have one of the news reports in there. The funniest thing to me is the reporter says, how do you say it? A satanic cult. He didn't even pronounce it right.
Yes, satanic.
Yeah.
and then in another clip, I can't remember if it made it into the film or not, but one other clip that I saw, they referred to the gazebo where they painted pentagrams and sold pot as a gazebo. And it always cracked me up because this clip has been on YouTube for years, and someone in the comments wrote, "Wow, I've never been in a satanic gazebo before." But, you know, that's, you know, we have the benefit of hindsight now to look at that and laugh, but make no mistake, at the time that was airing, it scared the hell out of a lot of people. And that's what I really tried to put across in the book and the film, because if you try and I'm not trying to sound like a boomer or anything here, but if you try explaining to the younger generation that people were scared out of their minds because a teenager was arrested in an AC/DC shirt, they're like, huh? What? You could go buy an AC/DC shirt at Walmart. I think you could buy an AC/DC onesie for your baby if you want to. But at the time, it was this vindication of something. That's why I talk about, you know, the proto-satanic panic, which is what I would classify the first case I wrote about in Death on the Devil's Teeth as. It wasn't full blown, you know, panic yet, but it was simmering. And it exploded. It came to a full boil with the Casso case, because now parents and church officials and people involved in schools and law enforcement, they all were now able to say, see, we told you that rock music was devil music. Look at the kid that's on the front page of every newspaper in the country right now, wearing an AC/DC shirt with Satan right on the front of it. He just dragged the kid into the woods and sacrificed him to the devil. We told you. Yeah. So they finally had this vindication, and it didn't matter to them that the story was completely skewed and the context was all messed up and certain things were just complete lies. But what mattered now was, this was no longer like Mike Warnke getting up on a stage and saying, well, you know, a pastor down in Louisiana told me this story about a girl that sacrificed the devil and they peeled her face off and cut out her sexual organs and then burned her in a trash dumpster. You know, this was, no, turn on the nightly news, grab any newspaper in the country right now. I mean, this was front page news for 2 weeks straight in America. So a lot of people took it very seriously, and we devote a segment in the film to not just people who knew Ricky and Gary in Northport, but like other artists that we spoke to that said, oh yeah, you know, right after, you know, that picture of Ricky in the AC/DC shirt hit the newspapers, my mom came in my room and tore down all my, you know, rock and roll posters, and I had to go to a different high school, and you know, or we, you know, we had to move. Like, this changed lives. People's lives were completely uprooted by this. This wasn't just like, oh yeah, for, you know, a couple weeks, you know, I couldn't talk about AC/DC in front of my parents. Like, we talked to Brendan Brown in the film, who was bullied by Ricky Casso as a kid growing up in Northport. And before he became famous as the lead singer and songwriter of the rock group Weedus, he was just this kid in Northport who, you know, was no longer able to go to Northport schools because his parents were terrified that he was going to get dragged into the woods and killed. So they sent him off to a boarding school in Mineola. Not, no fault of his own. He just happened to live in the town where this happened. And his parents were like, nope, we're sending you as far away from Northport as possible. So there were some definite consequences here. And who knows what happened to people all across the country that don't have a national platform like Brendan and the other people I interviewed in the book. You know, who knows what this was used to justify amongst average people in the middle of that whole, you know, moral panic. Like you mentioned, you know, Dungeons and Dragons. Like, it's so funny now because it's become Spielbergized in a sense. Like, mm-hmm. Dungeons and Dragons, a moral panic over Dungeons. You're talking about that cool thing that the cute little nerds in Stranger Things play on Netflix? Yeah. No, no way. It's like, no, this was a big deal. Like, you had pastors and newscasters saying, if you find your kid playing Dungeons and Dragons, they need to be saved.
It was teachers, it was parents, it was everything. And what I was about to say, mm-hmm. I actually talked about this, not Ricky's case, but I talked about a few weeks ago when it was Halloween, I talked mm-hmm. about the War of the Worlds broadcast, the radio broadcast, how that
in created, New Jersey,
how that created a panic. And you would think, we can't fall for that. But then, you know, the satanic panic. But today, and this kind of leads into how I want to wrap it up. Today, obviously, we have this thing called social media that connects literally mm-hmm. the world together. So, in your opinion, does that make it easier to create this kind of panic, or because there's so much info out there, people are just like, yeah, whatever, just another story?
No, it's all connected. It all runs in a linear thread. People seem to look back at these things and see them as isolated incidents that crop up, as opposed to what they really were, it's all one linear thing that occasionally the spotlight gets shined on. But when the spotlight goes away, it doesn't go away with it. It's always there. It's always waiting under the surface to pop up again. You know, in the 60s and the 70s, you had the panic caused by Rosemary's Baby and the Exorcist and Alice Cooper and mm-hmm. the popularity of Ouija boards. And that led into the satanic panic of the 80s, where you had all the cases we just discussed, Casso, the Judas Priest suicides, Ozzy, et cetera. And then it led straight into the 90s where the satanic panic turned into satanic ritual abuse, where all of a sudden people were having quote unquote repressed memories come back, like Michelle remembers and all that. And, oh, you know, I was kidnapped by a demon cult when I was a baby and I forgot all about it. And until I got this book deal and the chance to make $1 million. That led to things like the McMartin preschool trial, where you had an entire family's life. Their lives were just ruined. And, you know, you had children in a courtroom saying things like, oh, yeah, my teacher flushed me down a toilet and we went through a series of tubes and grandma was playing the piano in hell and, you know, pointing to pictures of Jesus and Satan. They were saying, like, can you identify Satan on this picture? And they were pointing to pictures of Jesus and Joseph Stalin, I think. It was absolutely ridiculous. And then, you know, only a couple of years later, there was the Goosebumps panic, as I mentioned. Mm-hmm. And then when the spotlight went off of that, we had Columbine, when things really got real. And people kind of forget the moral panic that led to that. But it was essentially the same thing as Casso, except in this case, instead of, you know, Casso and that supposed devil cult, the Knights of the Black Circle, it was, you know, Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris and the Trenchcoat Mafia. And instead of AC/DC, it was Marilyn Manson.
Yeah.
So
And the Matrix movie.
And now we see that leading into, you know, QAnon and all these other things, like, you know, instead of Ricky Castle and the Knights of the Black Circle and AC/DC, it's Tom Hanks and an island full of children and the Hollywood machine and all that. And I'm not trying to say pedophiles don't exist in Hollywood. I mean, obviously, you know, the Me Too movement has brought out a lot of shocking things about, you know, people that we never thought that was going to happen with. But the idea that there's these organized, you know, rings of pedophiles that are doing satanic rituals with children and that they secretly control the world, it's just another extension of a moral panic that has been going on for half a century by this point. And I'm sure if you're a historian, you could probably trace it back even further than the 60s and 70s. But it's this is just the new flavor of it that we're seeing now. And social media has lent a huge part of it. It's never been easier to share bull stories about Satanism and children, you know, being kidnapped and all this. And again, child trafficking is a huge problem in this country, just like child drug use was a problem in the 80s. You know, Ricky Casso, you know, he may not have been the leader of a Satan cult, but he was a mentally ill teenager that was self-medicating with some serious drugs. But does that mean he was part of a cult? No. Just like there are children being trafficked in this country, but is it being done as a mass satanic ritual? No. So we're just seeing new flavors of it. And unfortunately, I think we're going to keep seeing it. But as long as people can maintain some semblance of critical thought and look at past cases like the Casso case and the other cases that we mentioned in the film and see, oh, well, this is just, you know, the same old moral panic, satanic panic garbage that keeps getting regurgitated every few years. I think hopefully it will one day disappear. I do hope people will wise up. But, you know, everybody loves a good horror story and everybody loves a good conspiracy. So it's definitely an uphill battle right now.
Yeah, definitely. And to wrap up again, the movie, great job. Both you and Dan, great job on the movie. Thank you. Some of you have probably seen it by now. Like I said, it's out. I have a link on the show description for you guys to get it and watch it. If you can talk about it, I know this is keeping you busy promoting this one, but do you know what's coming up next for you?
Well, right now I'm working on another true crime book. It's called Room 100, and it chronicles the story of Sex Pistols bassist Sid Vicious and his girlfriend Nancy Spungen, and the mysterious murder case that swirls around it. It's another story much like the first two that I wrote about, where I went in thinking, okay, well, we're gonna do a cut and dry book here. It's gonna put all the facts in a row and the story will present itself. And of course, once I got into the nitty gritty of researching it, found out, wow, everything isn't what it seemed here. And, you know, things are a little murkier with this story than the public originally believed. So that I'm hoping to have out sometime next year. I'm also working on a revised and expanded edition of Death on the Devil's Teeth. Since it was published in 2015, we've received countless tips over at Weird New Jersey Magazine and over on my social media accounts from people that were familiar with the case and had information to offer. There have been developments in that case with the police that we're chronicling in that book. So anyone out there listening, if you happen to read my first book and you want to know more about that story, a new edition that is filled with new information is coming. And you can also check out a podcast that I do about that case. It's called it's just called Devil's Teeth, and it's available wherever you can get podcasts.
Yeah, I'll link that up on the show description. And in fact, tell them where website, social media, everywhere they can follow all of your work.
Sure thing. If you want to follow developments with the Acid King film, you can follow our production company. That's 1289 Films. We're on Instagram. Again, that's 1289 Films. If you want to follow me and my upcoming book projects and the articles that I write for Weird New Jersey, I'm at J Pollack Author. That's JPOLLACKAUTHOR. And that's on Twitter and Instagram. And, hopefully there will be some more projects in the future that really will bring to light a lot of these underreported cases, not just the unsolved cases, but stories that were either gotten wrong the first time or didn't receive enough attention, and maybe a little bit more understanding or a resolution can be found with them. Because that's definitely been my goal as a researcher and as an author and a filmmaker. You know, a lot of these stories, they were transformed into something else by people with agendas, or they were, you know, innocently misreported and they snowballed into misinformation. But now that we live in an era where people are connected through social media and, you know, it's easier to set up interviews for these types of things, and it's easier to get archives through, you know, these newspaper websites, and it's easier to get information to file Freedom of Information Act requests with local governments. I think the time is right now for these stories to be told properly, because they did affect a lot of people, especially, you know, in the Casso case. It not just uprooted that town, but the shockwave was felt all around America and arguably around the world. I mean, Ricky Casso may not be a household name anymore, but if you grew up in the 80s and the 90s, one part of your life culturally was definitely affected by it, whether it was, oh, you know, we don't want you listening to this devil music, or we don't want you trick-or-treating at night because the devil worshipers might get you. I mean, I certainly heard rumors like that growing up in New Jersey as a kid. You know, we weren't allowed to trick or treat anywhere near the golf course in Clark, New Jersey, because that's where the devil worshipers, you know, were sacrificing kids. So, you know, again, I hope people will check out the film, check out the books, and find some eye-opening details about a story that they've heard of and didn't know about before. Or if they're going in cold, they'll find a compelling story that is definitely stranger than fiction.
Yeah, so the book and the film, both called The Acid King. I have links to both on the show description. Jesse, thanks a lot for coming on. Like I said, great job on it. I'm sure everybody agrees that I've seen the film already. And you welcome back on the show anytime.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, we should definitely talk about some more of the paranormal stuff that I've talked about on Weird New Jersey sometime. Anytime an opportunity comes up for that, I'd love to come back on.
Absolutely. Count on it. Thanks, Jesse.
Thank you.
So for whatever reason, you didn't get a chance to record your ghost story for the Halloween episode, huh? But don't worry about it, because here's another chance for you. This year's Christmas episode goes back to a long-forgotten Christmas tradition. We're going to be telling ghost stories on Christmas Eve. You can share your brush with the other side, a haunting story, a poem or song, anything spooky to share on a cold Christmas Eve with all of the Paranormal Perception listeners. All you got to do is go to the show's website, www.paranormalperception.show, and click on the orange Start Recording button. Now, when you do, you're going to hear your recording on Friday, December 24th, 1 week before the Paranormal Perception season finale. And remember, all you got to do is go to the Paranormal Perception website. The button is on there waiting for you. Now, I can almost hear you guys asking, will there be presents? Well, actually, yeah, there might be. Not this week, but I have no promises, but perhaps next week I'm gonna reveal what those presents will be. No, I'm being serious. There might be some presents for you from Paranormal Perception. You're going to have to keep going to the website. A lot of teases going to the website, huh? You're going to have to keep going to the website to find out what those may be. So, fun interview. I know a lot of you were looking forward to it. You're big true crime fans. You love listening to podcasts, reading true crime stories. There you go. I have a link on the show description for you guys to watch. It's a pretty good documentary. It's a movie. But it's very well done. And I'm not saying that just because Jesse was on with me and he was a good guest. So next week, we go back to sort of normal around here. I'm going to introduce you to somebody who does what I do. Talk in a microphone about the paranormal. In fact, it's in his name, Paranormal Pete. Those of you that know who he is, looking forward to it. Everybody else, I'll introduce you to him.
And that
next week right here on Paranormal Perception.
Was Paranormal Perception.
The facts and opinions heard on this episode are those of the guest and host of Paranormal Perception. If they make you uncomfortable or cause you to question your outlook on life, good, you're waking up. Continue that journey on the show's official website, paranormalperception.show. Contact Henry with questions, comments, or if you'd like to be a guest on a future episode, henry@paranormalperception.show. Paranormal Perception with Henry San Miguel.